Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you understand the economic terminology at the heart of so much news reporting in recent years? And is it possible for those of us outside the world of finance to fully grasp the events and policies that brought the global economy to the brink of collapse? My guest today would argue that it is not only possible, but imperative that we educate ourselves on the workings of markets, and he's created a sort of primer to make that job a little easier. Patty Hirsch is senior producer of American Public Media's Marketplace. His new book is called Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple, and he's in town for a special Marketplace event that will air live tonight on KERA from 7 to 8. Patty, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris.
So talk about, I was delighted to get this book and to read through it, and I'm going to hang on to it. Talk about what made you realize it was necessary to put all of this in one place for people.
Well, you know, while the financial crisis was carrying on, we were trying to explain this stuff at Marketplace and on the radio and on the website as well. And we found that there was a real kind of desire from people that a desire for real explanation, not just of the really, really complicated stuff that was going on in the world, credit default swaps, CDOs, this whole kind of alphabet soup of malarkey that was going on Wall Street. People wanted to know the basics as well. They wanted to know the difference between stocks and equity. And the fact is, there is no difference. They wanted to know the difference between, you know, bonds and debt. And the fact is, there is no difference. So we wanted to, I really wanted to sort of pull these explanations together into one place so that people could have access to a primer that will say, not that you're a dummy, this isn't finance for dummies. You're a smart person, but this is complicated stuff, and here's an easy way to understand it.
And in fact, you use a lot of metaphors here. Is that the way that you find yourself trying to understand things when you have to go chase down a new term?
You know, we have at Marketplace, we have this morning meeting in the morning, and people will say, oh, what's on the news today? And they'll talk about something that's come out of Wall Street. And I remember having a discussion about this collateralized debt obligation, this CDO. And everyone was looking at each other around the place and saying, what the heck is this CDO? And I'd worked on Wall Street for a while beforehand, so I knew what it was. And so I used this metaphor to explain it. And rather than sort of using the language and the lexicon of Wall Street to explain what this is, which very few people understand, I thought, well, how can I explain it in a way that individual, ordinary people will understand? And I used this metaphor of a pyramid of glasses, the kind of thing that you pour champagne into, which describes a bond structure, a capital structure in one of these securitizations, as they're called. And immediately everybody said, oh, I can understand it now because I know what a pyramid of glasses looks like, but I don't know what an XYZ, ABC, whatever malarkey you're talking about that comes out of Wall Street's about. So I'm a big believer in analogy. I'm a big believer in metaphor. I'm a big believer in storytelling.
And so to expand on that, what happens is when there's collateralized debt obligations and there is a limited amount that gets paid back because of defaults and other things, mm-hmm. the glass at the top gets filled, but the ones at the bottom might not.
That's absolutely right. So if you think about, you know, if I'm glad we're getting right into the weeds here, Australia. This is great. So if you think about your champagne bottle, instead of filled with champagne, it's actually filled with mortgages. And every month, you know, a money gets thrown off those mortgages because people pay their mortgage. And the more people that pay their mortgages, the more kind of champagne spouts out of the top of the bottle, if you like, whenever you pop the cork every month. And like you say, that champagne then flows through this cascade, this pyramid of glasses. And if you're in the top glass, you do get filled first. But here's the thing. In a bond structure, like anything else, those are the safest bonds. They have the best rating, maybe AAA. They're super safe, but also they don't pay very much in interest. The lower ones, which are much less likely to get filled, especially if people pay less interest, they are much more lowly rated. They're the BBB-, maybe, you know, the C-rated, whatever. If they're much less likely to get filled, but they're also the juice there, the actual interest rate that gets paid is much, much higher. But that's what finance is all about, is risk and reward. The more risk you take, the more likely it is you won't get rewarded.
So let's talk about debt, because this has been such a buzzword in this election. You remind us that it is not necessarily a bad thing.
Absolutely not. Debt's a very, very good thing. Debt, in many ways, built this country. I mean, if you think about one of the things we hear a lot about right now is student education and student loans. And the fact is, without that student debt, it's very, very difficult for you to get to college, to get a really, really good degree. So again, it's risk and reward. If you take the risk to take out a large loan to go to Harvard or Princeton or some Ivy League place, you're expecting the reward to be equally large. there is a possibility, of course, that you could drop out. But that risk that you're taking could actually yield you a great reward in the shape of a great starting salary when you start at your investment bank or your law firm or whatever it is that you go to. So debt's a really, really good thing. It helps you to buy homes. It helps you to buy cars. And of course, people need cars to get to their jobs, which, you know, can then get more money from. So debt can be a very, very positive thing. Of course, too much debt and the wrong kind of debt can be a very bad thing. But it's not necessarily a bad thing to think. It's not necessarily a bad thing whitewash when people talk about debt.
How does the creation of prudent debt actually create money within the economy?
Well, if you think about this is the way the banking system makes money. So if you say you have $1 million and you go to the bank and you put $1 million into that bank, the bank only has to hold a certain amount of that money. Okay, it has to hold, say, let's say for argument's sake, 10%. So it holds, you know, $100,000 in the account, and then somebody else comes into the bank and says, "Can I borrow, you know, $900,000 to buy an airplane?" You say, okay, so you lend that person $900,000. Suddenly, there's $1,900,000, there's this $1.9 million mm-hmm. in the economy because there's your $1 million in the bank and you've got a credit there, which you can borrow against somewhere else if you want to. But there's also the $900,000 that they've lent to somebody else. And that person could then go and buy an aircraft for $900,000, and the aircraft manufacturer can then take that money and put that into the bank. Suddenly, you can start to see the cascade effect, the multiplication effect of money through the economy. So that's how banks actually create money. That's how debt can actually create money, which is a very positive thing for the economy.
So a lot of the problems we got into had to do with debt that was loans that were given to people who were perhaps not in a position to pay them back.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the criteria by which lenders decide that they will extend a loan to someone who wants to borrow money.
Well, I think, you know, anyone who's ever gotten a loan kind of already knows this. You know, you walk into the lending office and they look at you and they think, you know, how likely is it that this person's going to be able to pay this money back? You know, what sort of a credit risk are they to me? Do they have a job? You know, do they have you know, a support system behind them that could actually supply the money if they needed it, if they were in a pinch? Is there the ability for them to go and earn money with the money that I'm going to lend them, or the loan officer is going to lend them, in order to pay the money back quickly? So I think there are a whole bunch of sort of criteria that they put upon people. But then there are also criteria that they put on the loan. Like, say, for example, these things called covenants. You might have heard of these if you've ever borrowed money. Certainly corporations hear about these things all the time, because they'll go to a bank and the bank will say, okay, we'll lend you money on condition. And there'll maybe be 10, 15, 20 conditions, whatever they might be. It might be something like you have to earn a certain amount of money each month in comparison to the debt that you have, this ratio. They might say, you know, you have to be able to make payments on a certain date. And if you don't hit these covenants, if you don't meet these requirements, then they'll take the loan away from you.
So it would make sense that banks and other lenders would only want to give money to people who are well qualified to give it back. However, they can charge more if they're willing to take a little risk.
Exactly. There's the risk and reward. Once again, you know, if you lend to somebody risky, then the chances are higher that you're not going to get your money back. But at the same time, you might demand a higher interest rate to compensate for that risk. So, you know, banks are all about risk management. In fact, most banks have an entire risk management division which looks at, you know, how to manage the risk, how to take care of the risks that they're actually taking. So yeah, but it's like anything else. If I lend money to a friend of mine, if he comes to me and says, you know, Paddy, can I borrow, you know, $20 to go out on the town tonight? I'll think to myself, I don't know about John. You know, who knows what's going to happen to that $20? And I don't know if he's actually good for it, because he's always borrowing money. He very rarely seems to be able to pay people back. So I'm not too sure about lending to him. But then Jim comes to me and says, you know, can I borrow $20? And I know Jim's good for it. He's borrowed money from me before, very rarely, and he always pays me back the next day. I'm much more likely to lend to him because, you know, I know I'm going to get my money back. And that's the way that banks think. And they rate they decide on the amount that they're going to charge in terms of interest between these two types of people based on the likelihood that they're actually going to get their money back.
So once upon a time, a lending institution would give money to an individual, a corporation, whatever, and they would manage that relationship the entire time, for the entire term mm-hmm. of the loan. And then somebody got this bright idea that, well, you could charge a fee for lending out money, and then you could sell that risk on to somebody else, keep the fee, lose nothing, and hence was born the mortgage crisis decades after this began.
Well, I would say that this happened long before the mortgage crisis, but it really just spun wildly out of control at that point. I mean, you know, if you think about bonds, I mean, bond debt has been around for a very long time, and we've had the bond market for an extremely long time. And you can take bonds and sell them. I mean, there is a secondary market in bonds. And that's essentially the same thing. I lend somebody to some, say I lend you $50 and you write me a little note saying I owe you $50. That's my bond. I can then take that bond and sell it to somebody else. I could sell it for 100 cents on the dollar so I could get $50 for it and then you owe that other person $50 as opposed to me. Or I could sell it, you know, if somebody was... somebody really wanted security and was prepared to say, oh, you know, I absolutely know Chris is good for this. And I, you know, she's a good place to park my money. And, you know, maybe you're paying me a little bit of interest, like a dollar a week on that loan, on that bond, then they might be willing to take that for more than it's worth, more than the face value. So people have been doing that with bonds for a very, very long time. It's only happened with loans relatively recently in the last sort of 20 years or so. And with mortgages, this whole idea of lending a mortgage, as you say, taking that fee and then just selling it on without having to take any skin in the game, as it's called, without having to hold any part of that loan, that was a very new development that as you say, contributed largely to the collapse of the mortgage market.
And am I oversimplifying here to say that everyone assumed that the other guy was doing all the checking to make sure that the money would be there when it came time to send in that coupon with a payment?
Well, you have these, what happens usually when you have sort of mortgage-backed securities and these kinds of things, you have an organization, an agency that actually is supposed to keep track of where the money is being paid. And of course, if the money isn't being paid, if the interest rate isn't being paid on the loan, then they're the ones who start, you know, sending letters and, you know, sending around the hard men to try and make sure that you're actually doing the paying. Mm-hmm. So yes, that's sort of baked into the system.
Mm-hmm. But then that failed because people weren't checking, right? There weren't appropriate measures taken.
Well, it wasn't that there weren't appropriate measures taken. It was that you had just people who weren't paying their mortgages. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that people didn't know that the mortgages weren't being paid or that the interest wasn't being paid on the mortgages. It's just that people just flat didn't pay them because, you know, they were able to make the first payment and they'd been sold this ridiculous loan that, you know, clearly they weren't. Anyone who knew anything about loans, which the people who were borrowing them really didn't, anyone who knew anything about those loans knew they wouldn't be able to make the payments more than once or, you know, two or three months. And then, of course, they stopped paying and everybody knew that had happened. But you know, what could they do about it? There was no money in the bank for these people to actually make the payments. And then suddenly you started to see the impact on all these securitizations and then on the banks that were actually holding them.
And then if the houses weren't actually worth what the loans were established for, then even taking the house doesn't really get the money back to the bank.
Well, yes. And we have this problem now where you have banks that, you know, they've got a loan, these underwater loans where there's, you know, the loan is sort of worth $500,000, but the property is only worth $200,000. So, yeah, and the banks are taking the hit there, which is one of the reasons that, you know, the banks push back so hard against the moves to try and keep people in their homes and, you know, to reduce principal, which is the amount that people actually owe on the loan rather than just the interest. That's the reason they do that, because they're going to be taking a loss.
Mm-hmm. One thing I didn't know until I read this book was that when businesses take loans, typically they have varying interest rates, right? There's prime and then a little percentage over prime. Mm-hmm. And prime can change from one period to the next.
That's right. So the prime is what it's called. It's a floating rate. It goes up and down. It's this LIBOR is another one. We've heard a lot about that in the last couple of months.
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed. So say, for example, if you're going to get a 30-year mortgage, most of the time the lender is going to lend you a 30-year fixed rate. So that means you're going to be paying a certain amount of money every single month. But then they might also give you a floating rate, which is when it's maybe attached to prime or LIBOR, which, because prime or LIBOR go up and down and you've got a fixed rate on top of that, it means that your loan will float up and down. So that's the floating rate, which can actually vary. And these are a lot of the loans now that are being lent for shorter term loans, like 5 and 7 year adjustable rate mortgages.
Could be good for the borrower and could be bad.
Could work either way. Yeah. I mean, you're actually, when you're taking a floating rate loan, you are actually gambling on, you know, whether or not it would be better or worse than a fixed rate loan that you might have got from the same bank.
Patty Hirsch is with us. He's senior producer for Marketplace from American Public Media and author of the new book, Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. If you've got a question, call us now, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Patty Hirsch. He is senior producer for Marketplace from American Public Media and author of the new book, Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. Patty and his colleagues from Marketplace are in town for a special event airing live tonight on KERA from 7 to 8 o'clock. If you'd like to join the conversation now, maybe ask a question about that thing that you still don't fully grasp, join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, Patty, so since Bain Capital became a household word, leveraged buyouts has also been tossed around quite a bit. A little bit complicated, maybe. What does it mean?
Yeah, private equity is what everybody talks about. I love this word, private equity, because it's kind of like they've recast themselves. You know, they're like the phoenix rising from the ashes, or maybe the vampire rising out of its cave. I don't know. But private equity used to be called, as you say, leveraged buyouts. And you know, back if anyone's ever seen the movie American Psycho, for example, or this movie Barbarians at the Gate. I mean, leveraged buyout people used to have a really, really bad reputation. They used to be called asset strippers, where they would go and they would buy a company, sack half the staff or even more, strip it down, and then sell it for a profit sort of 6 months later. And that's really what private equity is about.
It's still happening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It never really went away. It kind of went into the background a little bit, and then it came out all sort of buffed up in a nice new suit. And that's what these guys do. So and private equity is, I mean, a lot of people sort of besmirch private equity. They say, oh, it's a bad thing. They use this term asset strippers. They say all they do is lay people off. But in actual fact, private equity can be a real source for good, because, you know, they're going to companies that are not performing particularly well, in some cases actually failing. And they are going in and they're making very, very hard decisions about what should happen. And that means a lot of the time laying off staff. It can mean, you know, laying off entire divisions, sometimes changing direction. But the whole point is to bring an organization back down to its nub, so that you can then start to build on that, so that you really start focusing on their core business, building on it to a point where you can actually sell it off for more money, say 3, 5, 7 years down the line, and then divide that money up amongst the partners of the private equity firm. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't.
So it's not so different from taking out a large mortgage to buy a house and fixing it up and flipping it down the line, right? There's some risk there, but theoretically, if everything works out, you make a big profit.
That's exactly right. I mean, say I get together with 10 other people, and everybody, because we're very, very wealthy, we all pitch in $1 million.
Here, so in public radio,
right,
yes.
Right, exactly. So we all pitch in. We've all got $10 million, and we want to buy a $100 million mansion in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. All right, the reason this is why it's called a leveraged buyout. So I'll take my $10 million, and I'll go to the bank, and I'll say, well, I want to buy this $100 million house, flip it, and sell it. Can you lend me the balance of this other $90 million. And that's where the leverage comes in. The bank will lend you a huge pot of money to do this if it trusts you, if it thinks you have a good track record. So I then take that money, I buy the house, I, you know, sack all the staff apart from the butler. I like rip down, you know, vast quantities of the building that aren't working particularly well. I remodel the place, I put in granite countertop and a new, like, nice new fridge in there. And I tidy up the grounds and all the rest of it, maybe sell a bit of them off. And then once I've turned that thing around, I wait for the market to improve, and then I sell that house off, and I sell it for double. I sell it for $200 million. I give the bank back its money right now, so the bank gets its $90 million, and I've now got, you know, $110 million that I can divide up with my friends, the 10 who went in with me. These are my partners. And that's what private equity does. It's exactly like flipping that house, but with way more debt, way more leverage, as it's called.
Okay, another big buzzword these days is derivatives. Explain what these are.
Well, derivatives, derivatives have a really, really bad name. People are like, oh my gosh, derivatives are so hard to understand. They're so difficult. But, I mean, they're actually not. They're actually if you look at the word derivatives, there's the explanation right there. It's something that's derived from something else. So you could say that the price of gasoline is kind of derived from the price of oil, right? Mm-hmm. It's a byproduct. Of course, that's not the way people really refer to the price of gas. So let's think about the typical derivative that we hear most about, which is the futures. People talk about the price of oil. They're talking about oil futures, orange juice futures, pork belly futures, all these kinds of things. These futures are based on the underlying asset, the price of the underlying asset. So in the case of, you know, frozen concentrated orange juice futures, they're based on the price of orange juice because of the orange crop. In the case of oil, the oil futures, it's based on the price of oil. But here's the thing. Nobody's actually buying, you know, gallons of oil, right? Barrels of oil. What they're doing is they're buying the option to buy or sell oil in the future. So they're buying a piece of paper that gives them the right to do something.
At a particular price.
Mm-hmm. And so that thing is derived from something else. Let me give you a good example. Unfortunately, I don't live in Texas, but I would think that a lot of people, you know, eat turkey at Thanksgiving here.
Absolutely. Some people shoot their own,
which is, well, in that case, you don't need to worry about this next part. But if you're the kind who doesn't shoot their own and you have to buy it from a supermarket, a lot of the time you're worried that, you know, when you get to the supermarket on the day before Thanksgiving, there's going to be no turkeys left. So you go 2 weeks beforehand, and the shop gives you a little slip of paper that gives you the right to buy, say, a 25-pound turkey for $50 the day before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. That is a future. Okay, it gives you the right to buy a certain asset for a certain price on a certain date. Now, if all the turkeys took flight the day after I get my little voucher, I could conceive, and you know, that means that the price of turkeys are going to go through the roof. Now turkeys are going to cost you $200. I could conceivably take my little piece of paper and go to my neighbor and say, look, I know you want a turkey. I'm quite willing to have ham this Thanksgiving. I know you really want a turkey. Why don't you buy my claim check for me for $5? It hasn't cost me anything. But by buying it for $5, you're now able to get a turkey for $50 whenever everybody else is paying $200. So that's the way you can make money using a future. And that's a good example of exactly what a future is. And we do it all the time, not just with turkeys. We do it with hire cars. We do it with hotels. We do it with airlines. Just booking a flight or booking a car is essentially giving yourself that option to buy something on a certain time, at a certain date, for a certain price. And that is a derivative.
And once again, there is a degree of risk there, as there is with any kind of variable rate interest on a loan, because all the turkeys could fly away and disappear, or suddenly there could be a glut of turkeys from Oklahoma that flood the markets in Texas, and then really a turkey's only worth $25 instead of $50.
Right. And, you know, if you haven't paid here's the thing. If you've just got a claim check that just allows you to buy something at a certain price, you could just toss that and throw it away. Mm-hmm. What people usually do in the futures business is they buy an option. So they might pay $5 for that claim check. So if you've paid $5 for that and the price of turkeys has dropped significantly, you know, suddenly you're losing money on the deal. Mm-hmm. There, you know, it's not worth you tossing that check away. So a lot of the time, the whole issue of whether or not to buy these, and a lot of people let these futures expire because it's not worth them cashing them in. But a lot of the time you're gambling, you're trying to lock in a price in the future, and there are risks associated with that.
And I suppose it's worth it for the manufacturer, the producer of these turkeys, to take that $5, because again, if the price changes, they've already locked into you being allowed to pay the lower price.
Right. And you know, manufacturers love this kind of thing, not manufacturers of turkey, obviously, but retailers of turkey, because it allows them to manage their inventory much better. Mm-hmm. And also it also allows them to actually get a little bit of money on the side. And of course, farmers love it too. You know, a lot of people think, oh, futures are just for Wall Street. Actually, no, futures are for farmers. I mean, farmers use these things all the time. It allows them to lock in prices for their crops or their livestock. It's a very, very useful thing. And we've been using these things for thousands of years. They're not new. We've been using them as part of they're part of the daily fabric of our life and have been for years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Marketplace senior producer Patty Hirsch. His new book is called Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. You can hear Patty and Kai Ristall and their colleagues in town for a special Marketplace event airing live tonight on KERA from 7 to 8. On the phone now, we have Kay in Ennis. Hello, Kay.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, well, it goes back to the mortgage fiasco and the downturn in the economy. I have thought that that deregulation was a big, if not the sole reason that the home loans failed as they did the mortgage industry.
Well, that's
and my problem is we had that savings and loan fiasco 20 years ago, and it just seems like history is repeating itself. And then we go into an era of let's don't regulate, and then it happens again. And so I'm just curious what impact that has on it.
Okay, I think that's a really, really good point. You know, regulation, a lot of people are very anti-regulation in this country, and often for good reason. A lot of the time we have too many regulations, we have conflicting regulation, you have this thing called regulatory arbitrage where you can shop around for the best regulation for you. So there's a lot of problems with regulation. But I think that one of the things that really interests me about the system in light of what happened in 2008 is that the financial services system has become, it reminds me of an adolescent boy who's growing really, really quickly, right? You know, but they haven't changed his clothes yet. He's still wearing, he's 18, he was 19 years old now, and he's still wearing the same clothes that he was wearing when he was 11, all right? So the clothes are ripping, you know, the shirt barely fits him, the buttons are all popping off, they're ripping all over the place. That's what our regulatory system is like, because in the last 20 to 30 years, our financial services system has grown in an incredible rate. And all of these, we've got the best minds in the country have gone to Wall Street and are inventing all of these incredibly complex systems that many people don't really understand. And the regulators and government, it's not that they're not smart, but they haven't got the resources and they haven't got the speed to keep up with Wall Street. So really what it's about is not the fact that we've stripped regulation away. I think it's that regulation simply hasn't kept up with the pace, with the advances of sort of Wall Street type technology. And I think that's what's really been the problem, is that, you know, regulation has fallen short, not because it hasn't been properly policed, although there are problems there also, not because it's been stripped away, although that has to some extent happened as well, but really because it simply hasn't kept up.
So talk about this. The Glass-Steagall Act separated the activities of markets and banks, essentially capital markets and banks, between 1933 and 1999. What was the consequence of its repeal?
Well, the consequence was that it was kind of like closing the door after the horse has bolted, because the whole, when people talk about Glass-Steagall, they say, oh, that allowed these banks to become these behemoths. It allowed them to combine their investment banking business, which is, you know, sales and trading and securitization and all that kind of stuff, with their retail banking business, which is kind of savings and loans. And so people say, oh, that opened the door to that. In actual fact, that had been going on for some time. I mean, you know, the government had been allowing banks, regulators had been allowing banks to buy securities businesses. Bank of America had done it. You know, Chase Manhattan Bank had done it. Citibank had done it. So really, the Glass-Steagall Act was just saying, okay, it's done. We may as well just repeal this act because this is already happening. Now, what it did, however, was it gave full license to the idea of building super banks. And we've now found the danger with super banks is that you can't let these things fail. They have become too big to fail. And the danger is that if one of these big behemoths topples, it'll bring the entire banking system with it. So when people talk about, you know, bringing Glass-Steagall back, that's what they want to get back to, sort of creating smaller banks. But I think, you know, the moment has really passed there. I don't think we can really go back to that, because for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because, you know, banking business has now become so intertwined, but also because our competitors around the world are allowed to do this. And if we want to compete on a level playing field, it's very, very difficult to do that if we're not allowed to combine securities and retail banking businesses.
We have an email here from Paul in Terrell who says, at the height of the housing bust, I heard Wall Street spokesman talking about moral hazard, meaning the bad behavior of people who bought homes and with mortgages that the banks talked them into with sales pitches that the buyers could not and were not meant to understand. Paul asks, am I an old crank for thinking I detect a whiff of hypocrisy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, moral hazard is all about, it's basically making a risk to do something under the assumption that you're going to be protected. So moral hazard, but moral hazard is nothing new. I mean, we've had moral hazard has been part of the financial landscape, you know, from the very beginning. I mean, if you look at, and in recent memory, if you look back to this long-term capital management, which collapsed, you know, in the 90s, that was really a case of hoping that, you know, that, well, we're not going to take the kind of risks that won't allow us to be bailed out. They said, well, we'll take a huge risk and the government will catch us, because that's what the government's there for, because the government doesn't want to take too many risks. It wants to encourage our kind of very entrepreneurial risk taking, which reaps lots of rewards for the economy. So therefore, you know, we'll take a risk and we'll see what happens, but everything will be okay in the end. And yes, it is. There's a lot of hypocrisy involved in that, because banks are doing it all the time now, in particular. Although they have to, I have to say, they have in recent years kind of ratcheted back. In the last couple of years, they've ratcheted back their risk taking. Their lending standards have increased. But there's absolutely no doubt that once they get back, that once they sort of switch back into risk taking mode, they'll be indulging in moral hazard once again.
We should be clear, though, that an economy that is entirely averse to risk taking, is also an economy that's not going to grow.
Right, and that's exactly the position that we have with the banks right now. I mean, I don't want to be necessarily a defender of the banks, but there's absolutely no doubt that they're being squeezed on both ends right now. On the one hand, they're being told you cannot take too many risks with your portfolio. You know, you've got to keep your lending standards smart because you lent really you lent in a stupid way, you know, prior to the financial crisis in the 2000s. And on the other hand, they're being squeezed because the government's saying to them, you've got to keep your reserves higher. Your loan reserve requirements have got to be higher. So suddenly the banks are like, well, we've got to keep more money in the bank, which means we've got less money to play with, and we're not allowed to take risks right now. So therefore, we're not going to be able to lend. And that's one. And it's actually a fair point when they say that it's actually very difficult for them to lend because of these two restrictions.
How do banks borrow money from each other or from the Fed?
Well, so there's this great system that they have called the overnight banking system. All right, and it's done in quite an interesting way. It's called, basically, they're lending to each other overnight because, you know, banks don't have actually that much money in their coffers. It's not like they're flush with cash and they can start, you know, pushing money around. Most of the cash is lent out. Most money is lent out. Banks don't like sitting on too much money because they can't make money out of it. Mm-hmm. What they want to do is get it out the door so it's paying interest. So sometimes they have requirements. You know, maybe they've got to make bond payments, you know, payments on investments that they've made themselves. So they need money overnight just for a short period of time. And they borrow that from each other in what's called the overnight market. And the way they do that is with what's called the repo system. And what the repo system is, it's a contract that's sold with the loan that allows them to buy the loan back. So the lender can actually recall the loan. And it's this, the Fed actually uses the same system as well. It's like this kind of recall system. It requires you to pay back the money when the repo is actually called in. It's kind of like a marker. You know, a marker is attached to the loan. So whenever the Fed wants its money back, or one bank wants its money back from the other, they call you up and they say, right, pay the money back.
But just for a few hours at a time.
It can be for a few hours. It can be overnight. Sometimes it can be for a couple of days. But these are very, very short-term loans.
Patty Hirsch is with us. He's senior producer for Marketplace from American Public Media and author of the new book, Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. Patty and his colleagues are in town for a special Marketplace event originating tonight at KERA and airing live from 7 to 8 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Patty Hirsch. He is senior producer for Marketplace and the whiteboard guru for Marketplace. He's also author of the new book, Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. He's in town for a special Marketplace event airing live tonight on KERA from 7 to 8 and originating from KERA. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ken in Dallas. Hey, Ken.
Hey. My question concerns the trade deficit. And as I read the paper, we have about a $50 billion or so trade deficit every month. And my question is, does that mean that the collective net worth of the United States is decreasing by that much every month and that we're pretty much headed toward financial decline as a result?
That's a good question, Ken. I don't think we can... I don't think we can say to ourselves, you know, the United States is heading into, you know, is circling the drain because of the trade deficit. I mean, most countries actually operate a trade deficit rather than a trade surplus. And, you know, the fact is that we're just like any other company, which is operating with debt. I mean, you know, some of the biggest companies in this country have operated with debt for a long period of time and you know, will hold a balance of debt simply because it gives them the freedom to do things that they wouldn't necessarily be able to do if they were just using cash. I mean, for example, you know, companies use debt. For example, one company I like to talk about is Yum Brands, which owns, you know, Pizza Hut and those companies, Taco Bell and the like. They at one point had an enormous amount of debt, and they used that in order to expand in China, to make a bunch of acquisitions, and now they're an exceptionally profitable company. They still hold debt, but they're not a poorly rated company, and they're able to operate pretty much with impunity because they can borrow at low levels like the US can, and they're able to do great things with that cheap money. So no, I don't think that the US is circling the drain because it's running a trade deficit. It's still able to borrow exceptionally cheaply. It's almost free money in that respect, and people are still very willing to lend to us. And I don't think there doesn't seem to be any danger in the short term or even the medium term, and certainly nothing that's, you know, sort of heaving over the horizon in the long term to suggest that that we're going to be sunk as a country. No.
You write here that the U.S. dollar is what's called a fiat currency. Mm-hmm. Explain what that means and the sort of power that gives the federal government to regulate the dollar.
Well, the fiat currency is something that came about. Well, I mean, fiat currencies have been around for a long time. They're basically, fiat means it is what the government says it is. Back in the 1970s, when Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard, that's when the U.S. dollar became a fiat currency. But until then, a dollar was worth a certain amount of gold. That's what the gold standard's about, and there's a bunch of politicians now who are talking about bringing back the gold standard, and there's some interesting discussion about it. And you know, imagine that if you were carrying in your wallet, you had a $20 bill. What used to happen was you would be able to take that $20 bill into a bank and theoretically exchange it for a certain amount of gold.
A little sliver of gold shaved off
for
you.
A few little crumbs there they'd give you. So that was the theory behind it. Every dollar was backed by a certain amount of gold that was held in reserve or held in account by the government. But that's like a really unwieldy thing, because what that does is if the price of gold goes up for whatever reason, suddenly your dollar becomes very, very expensive. And it actually can cause real problems with regard to buying things in the economy. So it can cause...
It's hard to export things.
It's hard to export. It's also becomes very, very, very difficult to buy stuff. Mm-hmm. If, you know, the price of gold goes up, and suddenly, you know, that means that, you know, a packet of cornflakes is now costing $20 as opposed to two. So there are real problems actually within the economy as opposed even... compared to actually exporting outside of the economy. So, and the other thing it does is it restricts countries and their ability to borrow, because and actually to deal with the issue of expanding their own monetary base. So for example, now we've realized in this country, or that the Federal Reserve has decided and the Treasury has decided, that they need more money in order to stimulate the economy. They've got the freedom to do that because they don't have to back every dollar with a piece of gold. They're able to say, look, trust us, this dollar is worth what we say it is. It doesn't need to have a certain amount of gold backing it up. And the reason they do that is because it then gives them the freedom to flood the money, to flood the economy with money, to get people working again and to get the system turning over. It's much, much more difficult to do that if you have a system where a dollar is backed by a certain amount of physical currency like gold.
How much inflation is just enough?
Well, there were people who would say that the kind of inflation we've got right now is just enough. I mean, a lot of people say
1 point something.
Yeah, it's 1 point. 1.3, I think, percent was recently. But I think that inflation is bad if it goes crazy. I mean, we've all seen these pictures of Weimar Germany, where people are sort of wheeling around, you know, wheelbarrows full of money
for a loaf of bread.
And this happened in Zimbabwe relatively recent as well. I mean, I think a friend of mine at work has got a copy of $1 million Zimbabwe note. You know, it's crazy. So that amount of inflation is obviously a bad thing. But a little bit of inflation is actually not a bad thing at all, because when the price of goods rises a little bit, It actually allows you to employ people. It gets more money coming into the system. It allows you to spend that money in other places. And of course, when you've got more dollars chasing a certain amount of goods, that sort of pushes the price of the goods up. People are able to charge more. Then they're able to pay their people more. Then they're able to expand their businesses. So a little bit of inflation is not a bad thing. In fact, it's a good thing. And really, the Federal Reserve's job is to try and get just that right amount of inflation to keep the economy ticking over and moving forward, but without slipping back into a slough in the way it is kind of right now.
So what is quantitative easing and how does that figure into all that?
Well, quantitative easing is the whole bit. Well, a lot of people call this printing money, and there's a big debate about whether or not quantitative easing really is printing money. It's not like, and this is what the Federal Reserve does, and this is the difference between, one of the key differences between the Fed and the Treasury. Whenever people say quantitative easing is printing money, it's not literally printing money. The printing presses are actually kept by the Treasury, which is a government department, whereas the Federal Reserve is much more independent. But the Federal Reserve uses quantitative easing to get more money into the economy. So what I want you to do is to imagine a paddling pool, okay, a kid's paddling pool, one end of which is kind of walled off. And most of the water is in this end of the is this walled off end of the paddling pool. So it's like there's a dam there. And in the financial system, that's where the banks are. The banks are sitting on most of the money, okay? And what they do is they sort of let the money into the wider economy, which is the shallow end of the paddling pool. And usually it's deep in the banker's end, and it's kind of splashing, paddling, just splash about like the way the kids like it in the rest of the pool, the rest of the economy. So you've got just enough money in the economy to keep things going, not too much, otherwise you'd have inflation and the price of goods would rise, and that would be a bad thing. So you've got just enough money in there. Now, what's been happening, though, is that the bankers have been hoarding all of the money. And it's not really their fault because we've been socking away money like crazy as well. We don't want to borrow because we don't want to spend. So all the money's in the deep end. And the bankers are like, well, we're sitting on this and it's we don't want to take risks. It's worth our while to have all this money swimming back here. So and usually when we're talking about the money that's in the system, it's the same money or it's the same water in the pool. So what the Federal Reserve does when it uses quantitative easing is it's like it's pumping extra money into the pool. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's pumping extra water in there. And that encourages the bankers to splash a bunch of it over the edge, all right? Because like I said before, bankers don't like sitting on money. They like to get it out there into the economy. So the more money there is with the banks, the more likely they are to push it out into the wider economy and at cheap rates so that people can start to spend and so that the economy will then sort of cycle through again. Because the more people spend, that means the more demand there is for goods. It means that people will hire more people, companies will hire more people, and you'll get that whole positive cycle going. The problem is, of course, is getting that money back out of there. And that's where these repos come in, where the bank has these repurchase or the Federal Reserve has these repurchase agreements attached to the money that it's put into the system. It then forces the bankers to shovel that money back out to the Fed whenever it needs to take the money back out again. So there is a stopgap there, but people are very, very worried about the effect that quantitative easing could cause down the line.
So I guess overall economic growth represents what? You get a bigger rating pool. You replace the one you had with one that has a larger capacity on both sides?
Yes, I think that's a very good analogy. That's nice. That's a nice way of pushing that out, yeah.
Okay, so we have an email here from Angela who wants to know, is an economy without growth unthinkable? What would be the impact?
An economy without growth. Well, an economy without growth would be, you'd have to assume that nothing was growing. So if you had no population growth in the economy, then that might be okay. But what happens if you have an economy that you know the population is growing but the economy itself isn't? That means that the implication is that all those people would be unemployed, they wouldn't be able to get jobs, and then you've got the amount of money that's in the economy, the amount of gross domestic product, if you like, can only be shared out between all of the people that are in the economy. So if population is growing and the economy is contracting or staying still, then people have got less, there's less money to go around, there's a smaller share. Now, some people might say that maybe that's a good thing. I personally don't think that is a particularly good thing because it means that then you can't compete with other economies. It means that, perhaps the area that you're specialized in, somebody, a growing economy might sort of decide to poach that from you. And that could leave you with a real problem. So I think a stagnant economy is not a particularly good thing. Nobody wants a stagnant economy.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jimmy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi, yes, Jimmy.
Thank you. This is a very good subject to, in fact, to explain something simple to me and on the level I can think of. It's very good. I'm looking from a historical point of view. Throughout history, we've had various monetary systems, economical systems of all kinds and types. However, it seems like they always end up the same. The money goes to the top and leaves most of the people without any money. And that's pretty simple. I could probably find some more rhetoric or fancy words for it. But here we are again, stirring the same old bean pot, and we've been doing it since we've been putting our history down, you know, and taking account of these things. And some of it's still going. We have different systems all over the world even now. Unfortunately, now, though, we have a product that we've globalized, and it's on a global basis. And when is the mankind or these economists or someone going to settle down, sit down, and structure an economical monetary system that'll work for all of us, that is, in the world?
Economics, history, philosophy, all wrapped up in Jimmy's question. What do you have to say, Patty?
Well, you know, Jimmy brings up a really interesting point here, which is that, you know, we're talking about this disparity now between between the rich and the poor, and the fact that that gap is really, really widening. And a lot of people are really, really worried about the middle class, because, you know, the middle class appears to be disappearing. It's being eroded at both ends. You know, some are filtering up into the upper classes in terms of income, but frankly, not very many. Generally, more and more people are dropping into poverty. You know, the middle class itself is, you know, we're seeing wages declining in real terms. You know, more people are, the way that people actually are able to spend is through borrowing. They're using debt as opposed to actually earning money. I think Robert Reich at one point said that The wages haven't risen in real terms since 1973, which was astounding to me. So, but that's a scary thing. And I think that really what Jimmy might be aiming at here is what happens to the middle class now? Because we've seen changes. And in fact, on the show tonight, one of our reporters, Chrissy Clark, is going to be talking about this, about what the middle class is, what's happened to the middle class, and what might the middle class be in the future. And it's a very provocative conversation, because a lot of people are saying that this change in the way that we do business that's been wrought really by technology is very similar to the change that happened whenever we had the first middle class, which were these sort of yeoman agrarian farmers. And they were kind of wiped out by the advance of technology during the Industrial Revolution. And everybody became, or many, many people became factory workers. And so what this conversation that we're having tonight is all about that shift. And what do you do whenever, you know, people have been sort of pushed out of their jobs by an advance in technology? What then happens to the middle class? You really have to create a middle class. And that's what they did during the Industrial Revolution. That's when worker protections were brought in. That's when you had things like, you know, the minimum wage was brought in. And, you know, factory workers eventually became one of the most coveted jobs in the economy. So we're at a point now, I think, or we're verging on that point, where the middle class is changing radically. And we have to decide what that middle class is going to be. You know, what type of jobs those are going to be. Perhaps they'll be custodial jobs. Who knows? And, you know, how that's going to play out in the future. But what Jimmy says is on a lot of people's minds right now. That disparity between rich and poor it's not getting any better.
Can you talk just briefly about, is there a working definition for what middle class is? Because it's one of those things that it's like pornography, I guess. Everybody sort of knows it when they see it, but it's hard to find an exact definition.
I actually don't think there is one. I mean, when you listen to the rhetoric during this election, you hear what, you know, President Obama and Governor Romney say. It's actually really difficult to work out what the middle class is. Are they people who earn $250,000? Are they people who are just above the poverty line? I don't know. That's a really broad church. Maybe that really is the science of it. What's really interesting is that when you ask people, both people who are extraordinarily wealthy and people who are living in poverty, if they think that they're middle class, a lot of the time they say yes.
Patty Hirsch is senior producer of American Public Media's Marketplace. His book is called Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. He's in town for a special Marketplace event that you can hear live on KERA tonight from 7 to 8. Patty, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, it's been wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.